Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
Sun-grown coffee requires chemical inputs. So you have chemical fertilizer, pesticides, herbicides, nematicides, fungicides that all need to be administered.
And that causes problems not only for the workers, but also the environment. Catherine Tucker will tell us more about her research with coffee growers in Central America. Why do the price of tomatoes vary so greatly? Harvest Public Media digs into the hidden costs of tomatoes. Frog legs are on the menu with Chef Daniel Orr, and they're really delicious. And foodie businessman Jeff Meese introduces us to his baby water buffalo, Shadow. If he has his way, his water buffalo will be incorporated into farms all over the Midwest. Let's check in with Luann Johnson, who brings us news stories from the food world.
Orange juice sales are at their lowest in decades. That's according to a story on NPR's blog, The Salt. Reduced production is partly to blame. Last year, Florida growers harvested just over 100 million boxes. That's half of what they collected 10 years ago. Farmers point to a disease called citrus greening that has hit orange groves all over the state. It prevents the fruit from growing to full size, and instead of a bright orange color, the tiny fruit blush green. Eventually, citrus greening will kill the plant altogether. The industry is devoting millions of dollars to try to find a solution to citrus greening. Are researchers close to finding a solution for nut allergies? Maybe, but they're not treating the people. They're treating the nuts by disrupting the structure of nut proteins. As NPR explains, nut allergies typically flare when an antibody in the immune system binds to the nut's protein, triggering a reaction. Scientists have devised a tactic to trick the body. Modify the shape of the proteins so the antibody can't recognize them. But don't expect to see hypoallergenic nuts on store shelves anytime soon. Right now, researchers are only working with nut extracts, and they're not sure what modified whole nuts would taste like. 19 million Americans suffer from nut allergies. Specifically, the number of kids with peanut allergies has doubled in 10 years. In Indiana food news, the Bartholomew County Commissioners agreed to implement a one-year moratorium on concentrated animal feeding operations, or CAFOs. The moratorium applies to farms with more than 300 cattle, 500 horses, 600 hogs, 600 sheep, or 30,000 fowl. The vote comes after months of debate in the county, which was initially sparked by farmers requesting zoning permissions for new hog farms in the area. After the request was made, residents against the operations banded together, expressing their worries about how waste from the facilities would affect air and water quality, among other concerns. The county commissioners must still vote again to finalize the moratorium. And agriculture experts are trying to determine whether regional food hubs would be feasible in Indiana. Here's how food hubs work. Farmers post their products online for order. They deliver the food to an aggregation point. Organizers of the food hubs then take care of the marketing, the transactions, and delivery of the products. Meetings will be held in several communities across the state where educators will talk to residents to determine the size of the demand for more specialty crop food hubs. Specialty crops are defined as fruits, vegetables, tree nuts, dried fruits, horticulture, and nursery crops. The study is funded by a USDA specialty crop block grant. Links to these stories are at eartheats.org.
We're at Earth Eats on Twitter and Facebook. Add us to your social media routine. Thanks to Luann Johnson.
Till next time.
Late summer in the Midwest is tomato season. And whether you're shopping at the grocery store, a discount chain, or your local farmer's market, you'll find the price varies for a plump, juicy tomato. While sun and rain might be free, tomato farmers have to carefully weigh everything else they put into growing their crop. Harvest Public Media's Christopher Husted visited Herman's Farm in St. Charles County, Missouri, to find out more.
In the back of a barn off Highway 94, Elsie Goki holds a rag and stands at a table surrounded by buckets of fat, red tomatoes. It's been raining off and on this early August day, and the tomato pickers have been rushing the ripe ones into the barn.
I'm just wiping them off because they were wet. I usually don't do this.
Yeah, we don't have to.
I usually stand up in front and wait on customers.
Yeah.
They grow a variety called Red Deuce, and they're huge. Her husband, Tom, picks up a tomato the size of a teapot.
Isn't this sad? Look at that. How beautiful that is. Display.
A crack runs the length of the tomato from top to bottom. Goki says it got too much rain while it ripened on the vine.
And it's no good no more. Now we just throw it away. But what a shame. Look how beautiful.
Oh, we could eat
look
it.
Look how thick they are. Well, there's so many of them.
I know.
Although the rain has cost the Gokis a few tomatoes today, they've had a successful growing season so far. Tom Goki says it costs him about $15,000 to put in an acre of tomatoes. This year, he planted 3 acres. At about 5,000 plants per acre, he's mid-sized with at least 15,000 plants.
Notice how thick they're hanging on here? We've been picking on this block of tomatoes for the last 5 weeks, and they're still producing.
Goki grew up in a tomato farming family. He says the cost of labor has dropped dramatically since he was a kid, thanks to advances in technology and equipment. Just a decade ago, he says each tomato plant had to have its own stake. Now, they stake every few plants and run twine between them for support.
There's only 20% of the labor that goes into raising this acre of tomatoes today than it was 25 years ago.
But not all costs have dropped. Seed that used to cost $16 an ounce can go for 100 times that today.
But they have got so much more disease resistance built into them that you don't have to give them so much tender love and care like you did years ago because they were so touchy.
Advancements in fertilizer and fungicides have forced Goki to dig deeper into his wallet. He says the chemical bill used to run him about $7,000 for 30 acres. Now that chunk of change only covers 8 acres.
A sack of fertilizer 20 years ago was $5. Okay, now it's $25. And it goes on and on.
Running a tomato farm is risky, Goki says. A bad year of pests, and you're out thousands of dollars. But those pricier products help protect his livelihood by keeping his plants healthy and productive.
If I average a buck to a buck and a half a pound, and I pretty much do, okay, and if everything works out well, don't have any hail and everything like that, I could possibly pull easily 50,000 pounds, okay, and actually gross that much money off of an acre of tomato.
That's 50,000 pounds per acre in a good year. Wholesale, each pound goes for $1.50. Of course, at the grocery store, you'll probably see these tomatoes at about $3. Christopher Husted, Harvest Public Media.
Harvest Public Media produces stories about the food system. Connect with them at harvestpublicmedia.org. If you're listening to me right now in the morning, there's a 60% chance that you have a cup of coffee in your hand right now. Or maybe you like a decaf double soy latte from your local coffee shop. You and all the other specialty coffee drinkers in the U.S. spend about $18 billion a year on frou-frou coffee beverages. But today, it's not about our caffeine addictions or how much money coffee shops are making off us. It's about the growers, the people at the very beginning of the process. Catherine Tucker is an associate professor of anthropology at Indiana University, and she works with coffee growers in Honduras and Guatemala. She's reeled in her coffee consumption over the years.
There have been times in my life where it's probably been closer to 8, but right now I'm about 1.
Only 1 cup a day. Gosh, there's no way. She's part of a collaborative project studying whether fair trade certification results in better economic situations for coffee producers. She says determining an empirically defensible estimate of coffee production was not easy.
And that meant counting every bean on certain plants. So, yes.
How many coffee beans grow on a plant?
That depends on the plant. There's some branches that have 300 coffee beans and some that have 10.
I caught up with Catherine Tucker following her talk at last year's event at Indiana University called Big Red Eats Green. She loves the Southeast Asian coffees because they're lower in acid and they have a rich, robust, complex flavor.
And if you were going to compare it to a wine, it's like a very rich, full-bodied red wine. And that's my favorite cup of wine and that's my favorite cup of coffee.
Can you describe how the bean that produces that coffee is grown?
I do try to buy coffee that has been produced organically that implicitly means that it's also been shade grown. Most of the, say, the Sumatran coffees, I love Sumatran coffee, and also like the Ethiopian Sidamo, are still processed by traditional means in which the coffee bean is dried with the cherry on it. There's only a few places in the world where that actually works well, because in most places it is too humid for coffee beans to dry without fungus growing on it during the drying process. So you have to get the cherry off right away before it starts to ferment. But for Arabica coffees, there's these select places where you've got the sun-dried coffee, and those have a richer flavor. They also have the advantage of using less water for processing and being a bit easier on the environment.
Let's backtrack a little bit. The crux of your talk, or at least what I got from it, was that shade-grown coffee is better, just generally. Mm-hmm. Why don't all coffee growers grow shade-grown coffee if it's better?
Shade-grown coffee tends to have lower levels of productivity and requires greater inputs of labor, because you have to substitute chemicals used in sun-grown coffee with human labor. Sun-grown coffee requires chemical inputs. So you have chemical fertilizer, pesticides, herbicides, nematicides, fungicides that all need to be administered, and they cause health problems for the workers who administer them, usually have minimal or no protection. And then you have all of those chemicals running off into water sources and getting into the soil. Then the other aspect of sun-grown coffee, of course, is that it completely destroys biodiversity.
I'm sure when you give this information to students, they think, I have to stop drinking coffee. This is far too complicated. I can't be an ethical coffee drinker because there are just too many issues here. What do you tell them?
I say don't stop drinking coffee, because there's 25 million coffee growers on this planet that depend on people buying coffee. So instead, consider making wiser coffee choices by buying coffee that has been produced in ways that are more environmentally sustainable, like the organic shade-grown approaches, and are more likely to support social justice because they pay the farmers better. And, of course, one of the biggest problems that I don't think I've mentioned yet in talking to you right now is that most coffee farmers are barely making it because they're getting so little for the coffee that they grow. While in the conventional markets, a few very large transnational corporations dominate the purchasing, and they are making more and more money. They've been essentially getting windfall profits for the past 15 to 20 years and have been driving prices lower for coffee farmers. I think that coffee is really interesting, and I also see it as a way for understanding some of the larger challenges that we face as consumers in a very complex world.
Awesome. Thanks.
You're welcome.
Catherine Tucker is an associate professor of anthropology at Indiana University. Coming up, Chef Daniel Orr turns one of his favorite childhood dishes into something a little fancier.
When I was a kid, we used to get those jumbo frog legs, but I like to use ones that, you know, they're about 2.5 to 3 inches long. Then I marinate them with a little buttermilk.
Yep, frog legs. They're really good. Hear what other goodies are part of this recipe ahead. Support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, now with 5 locations in Bloomington. Blooming Foods has supported locally produced food and artisanal goods since 1976. BloomingFoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels at the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, one block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness Massage and Yoga, 812-337-3529 or 33-RELAX. and Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Welcome back. This is Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan. Riley Lewis is the fourth generation of his family to work his Iowa farm, and now his son is the fifth. The long line of Lewis family farmers stretches way back, almost 150 years. Amy Mayer has this week's installment of My Farm Roots.
I'm Riley Lewis. My wife and I, of 40 years, live at Forest City, Iowa. We have a farm that we raise corn and beans, and then we also raise hogs that go to market. Our farm, we happen to have the documents here, and Forest City was settled in 1855, and we have it's called a warranty deed that comes from the United States government, and at that time, they gave veterans a quarter section of ground if they would build a house on it and live there for 1 year. In 1860, the first from the United States government went to a private that fought in the War of 1812. And so he moved here northeast of Forest City and lived there for 1 year, and then he sold it to Robert Clark, who was the founder of Forest City, and he was into land acquisition. And then he turned around and sold it in 1871 to my great-grandfather. The land is slightly rolling. It was formed by glaciers that came here. The land is really fun to see the seasons change during the year from the winter to the summer, and to see how life comes about. And there's always something about seeing rows of corn that just extend beyond the horizon, how fast they grow and how the seeds germinate and all the things that have been provided by God for us to enjoy out here. As a farmer, I've always thought that I'm in a faith-based operation, because nobody depends upon what the good Lord gives us more than a farmer out here. Doing what our fathers did, what our grandfathers did, working the same land. All of the farms that we go on have memories in my mind where Dad got stuck, or my grandfather, the bales fell off of the hay rack on the side hill, or we always remember about a major breakdown, or a year when a hailstorm came through, or those memories on the farm are always embedded in you, and especially when you take over what your dad and your grandfathers have worked so hard to acquire.
Farmer Riley Lewis, as part of the My Farm Roots series from Harvest Public Media. Get more profiles like this, as well as in-depth news stories, at harvestpublicmedia.org.
Leaping lizards. I usually just do these on leap year. Ba-dum-bum. Serve them with Frog's Leap Vineyard wine. Ba-dum-bum. All right, here.
You'll be here all day. When you were a kid eating these, this frog's legs didn't gross you out?
Oh, I love frog legs. I mean, I think it's whatever you're raised on. And still, if you go to places like Nashville, Indiana, and you go to the IGA grocery store, they have frog legs because people eat frog legs there. All right, so we got our frog legs. I like the smaller ones. When I was a kid, we used to get those jumbo frog legs. But I like to use ones that, you know, they're about 2.5 to 3 inches long. Then I marinate them with a little buttermilk. In the marinade, I've got some garlic, some crushed red pepper, and a little lemon zest. And then we mix that all together. A little bit of salt and pepper. Okay, now it's best to let these sit in the mixture for about an hour, and that allows the buttermilk and the flavorings to sink in. And then we're going to add one egg, and that's going to help adhere the crust to the frog legs. Okay, we're going to really toss the frog legs in with the buttermilk and egg mixture, put them in the flour mixture, and then toss those again. And we want to give them a nice coating of the breadcrumbs. Now let's go over to the stove. All right, so we've got those well-coated frog legs. We're going to drop them into some nice hot oil. I've got about a quarter inch of oil. You can hear those sizzling in the pan. We're going to turn down the heat a little bit. We're going to cook them about a minute and a half on each side until they get really, really crunchy. Since they are small, they don't take a long time to cook.
Looking good.
After that first side is cooked, we're going to flip them over. And you can see they're nice and crunchy, kind of like fried chicken.
They really do taste like chicken. That's not just a saying.
Well, you're gonna know.
This is going to be my first frog leg of my life.
Really?
Ever.
Have you had snails yet?
I have had escargot, yeah.
So, you know, some French delicacies.
Wait a minute. If I said no, I hadn't tried snails, would we have done that next show on Earth Eats?
Yes, I think we may have to do some snails next.
I've also never had filet mignon.
Okay. And caviar and foie gras, right?
Exactly.
All right. Once these get nice and crispy, and what we want to do is we're looking at the pan, and we want the oil that's in the pan to go clear again. That will mean that all the moisture has been cooked out of the flour and the frog legs, and that will mean that they're crispy and they're done. So you can see that kind of that white foamy look is going away, and we're getting more clear oil. That's allowing us to know that our frog legs are getting close. Okay, so we discard all that oil, but we still have that nice hot pan. It still's got some nice flavors in there from the seasonings. Throw in our butter. Okay, and you can see it's nice and foamy. We're going to go ahead and add the garlic, a quarter cup of butter, and a good 2 tablespoons of garlic, 1/2 tablespoon of lemon zest, and 1/2 cup of parsley. We add our frog legs back, and then we add a little salt and pepper. Toss the frog legs back on the platter, and those are our grenouille à la Provençale, or French style frog legs with garlic and parsley.
This wonderful recipe is on our website, along with lots and lots of other fun dishes, eartheats.org. If you're in Kentucky looking to do some bullfrog hunting, the season runs through the end of October. In Tennessee, it's year-round. From the kitchen, now back to the farm with Jeff Meese. He's a Bloomington businessman with a passion for farming and animal husbandry, specifically one rather unusual animal. Come with us as we visit the place he calls Lush Farm. No matter how busy he is, Jeff Meese will always make time for one thing.
There you go, sweetie.
What's her name?
Oh, this is Shadow.
Shadow's 9 weeks old, and she's an orphan.
What? How are you? How are you?
And she's a water buffalo. Do you think she knows her name?
I think it's getting there.
Jeff has 26 other Asian water buffalo. All of them shunned Shadow when she was born. So now she spends most of her time with humans and the farm dog, Louie.
She doesn't even know she's a buffalo, I think, by now.
So that we're all on the same page, these animals are not the humpbacked Great Plains American bison. Asian water buffalo pretty much look like cows with a striking set of horns. These horns can either coil like Raleigh Fingers' mustache or jut out like scythe blades. Shadow's horns at this point are just nubbins.
You want to do a little walking with us, you? Huh?
You can guess by the name that these Asian water buffalo are not native to Indiana. So why did it seem like a good idea to bring these animals to Midwestern America? First, you have to understand what motivates Jeff Meese: food and community. He's a very successful restaurateur. He owns Pizza X, a local pizza delivery chain, Lenny's Restaurant, and the Bloomington Brewing Company. For fun, he runs a farm.
You know, some people golf, some people love movies. I like to get out here and
feel nature and grow stuff, give it away.
He grows hops for the brewery. His 80 tomato plants produce all the tomatoes for Lenny's.
You see, even Shadow likes tomatoes. She's been eating the plants. The plants are supposed to be poisonous. Don't eat too many of those.
He also had a vision to make his own cheese, this one specific kind of cheese, buffalo mozzarella. He first experienced it in Italy, where they milk the water buffalo, make the mozzarella, and sell it at the market all on the same day.
The mouthfeel and the flavor of it is just exquisite. You know, you would sit down and eat a baseball-sized chunk of this cheese and want more. After it's been refrigerated, then it's considered to have a much lower value and they use it on, like, pizza.
That was Jeff's grand plan. Buy 9 water buffalo with the intention of milking them for cheese. And then the problems started stacking up. As the herd grew in size, simply raising the animals took a lot of time. He realized his 70-acre plot of land was too small for the number of animals he would need. Not to mention constructing a creamery. That would have been quite an undertaking. So now what? He still wanted to produce something, but instead of cheese, what if the buffalo were the product?
I realize I can't do it all myself, and so I'm working on finding interested people.
He wants to transform his farm into a breeding operation so he can get water buffalo out into this part of the world. He envisions southern Indiana as a national hub for Asian water buffalo.
You know, if I've got to give them buffalo, that's what I'll do, but sort of almost find a few people that it's free to a good home.
2 of his bulls are headed to a farm in Vermont. Any takers locally? Not yet.
Come on, Shadow. Keep stepping, girl.
Jeff says everyone who meets Shadow falls in love with her a little bit, and I can vouch for that. Right now, she's adorably clumsy at just under 200 pounds. She'll grow to 8 times that size when all's said and done.
There she comes. Whoa. So she runs up and butts you, which is going to be no good when you get bigger. So we're not sure just how we're going to deal with that.
He has 20 years to figure that out.
Yeah, good girl.
Jeff makes it abundantly clear that Shadow is his favorite, because she's like family.
Oh, I think once you give him a name, yeah, she is like family.
He puts Shadow back in her pen until tomorrow. There's one thing you do online today. Go to our website and look at a photo of Shadow. She's quite a creature. EarthEats.org. Our Earth Eats crew includes Aabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Mark Chilla, Luann Johnson, Liz Leslie, Daniel Orr, Betsy Shepherd, and all the folks at Harvest Public Media. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, now with 5 locations in Bloomington. Blooming Foods has supported locally produced food and artisanal goods since 1976. BloomingFoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels at the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, 1 block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness Massage and Yoga, 812-337-3529 or 33RELAX. And Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. Had a great time with you this week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Annie Corrigan for Earth Eats.